Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, greenwashing culture, how journalism, the entertainment industry, and museums impact the environment. And first, what is the role of psychological first aid in times of crisis? Lillian Ng explores ways to support psychological well-being with Carrie Gibson and Zubaida Mohammadi.
What is the role of psychological first aid in times of crisis? To explore this question, I am joined by Kerry Gibson, a clinical psychologist and researcher in trauma and youth mental health, and by Zubaida Mohammadi, who is an adult psychiatrist with a special interest in maternal mental health. Just want to acknowledge this profound time of disorientation and disruption. First of all, I might start by asking, what is psychological first aid?
Basically, when we think of psychological first aid, it came from a recognition that the kind of way that people respond to those situations immediately afterwards, in the immediate aftermath of a trauma, or indeed during the trauma, while it's happening, while people are dealing with these difficulties, that the way that people respond to that can be crucial in influencing people's recovery. And we find that if people are able to respond in helpful ways, that actually people get over these situations much more easily. The analogy here would be general first aid, where somebody has an injury and somebody rushes up in the moment. They don't have a huge amount of equipment. They don't necessarily have extensive medical training, but they're able to do what is necessary in that moment to kind of settle the person, to deal with the medical emergencies, and to get them in touch with the support or other resources that they need to carry on. So we borrowed that analogy and we're kind of using it now for psychological issues. So that's really where it comes from. COVID-19 is something which is a sort of unfolding trauma, a kind of a crisis time, if you like, in which people are continuously being stressed by new demands, by the unknown, by threats to their health in an ongoing way. So all of these things are kind of trauma.
So this was introduced in the mid-20th century, where we were looking at people who had been exposed to a crisis or disaster, and then it was expanded to include disaster responders post 9/11. And the entire principle is aimed about first do no harm, but also about basically fostering adaptation in patients or people, and also about being able to offer some kind of care and formalizing good common sense at the end of the day. And it would be looking at activities that any sensible, caring human being would offer to someone else in a similar situation.
So just thinking about psychological first aid as one of a number of responses psychologically and socially for people, who can deliver it? Can it be learnt by anyone?
We can say that it can be learnt by anybody. It can be delivered by anybody. I think the first and foremost thing is to understand that there's many guidelines around psychological first aid, and they all have similar elements. And the elements around most of the guidelines are safety, calming, connectedness, self-efficacy, and hope. And what we want to say is that this does not need to be delivered by mental health professionals, but rather be looking at people who might be community responders, volunteers, clergymen, teachers. And I think what's far more important, even before we get there, is if you feel that you are capable of being able to deliver this, then you can do that. And the training can be offered online. There's various forms of training by the WHO, various Red Cross agencies as well.
A lot of people do this anyway. As you say, it's a kind of a common sense thing to do. I mean, it's the best form of common sense in the sense that it's sort of empathic and kind and thoughtful. But in many situations, it's the ordinary person, you know, it's, as you say, it's the teacher in the classroom. It's even the family member with their elderly aunt who's having to help out and kind of settle them in a frightening or crisis situation. And so this is not a kind of highly professional intervention, although it does have some kind of strong evidence behind it. It's really giving you a bit of a framework for just knowing what kinds of things might be helpful to say and do when somebody's in a state of distress. And it's not a set of absolute rules, but it's a kind of a guideline for how to be.
One of those elements is safety. What are ways to help and promote a sense of psychological safety?
Firstly, safety from a psychological perspective. You want that person to feel that you are caring, that you are empathic, that you approach them with respect, respecting their dignity, but also about being culturally sensitive in that arena. Once you are there, you also have to think about how to maintain privacy and being able to ask, maybe not necessarily ask, but being able to approach certain aspects sensitively in terms of the trauma that's there. Simple things, introduce yourself. Let them know that you're just there to help. You may not necessarily need to talk. You do not need to pressure them to talk. It is just about being able to listen, maintain eye contact. I think, you know, a very humane thing is about offering to just hold someone's hand. And that is something that we cannot do in an environment like COVID, which makes it even more difficult to offer that empathy in that situation and that caring. And I think if you just be able to maintain that contact and show your caring and empathy, that grounds that person to be able to connect with you.
Yeah, so that safety originally came from the idea that if somebody were in a sort of a disaster situation, an earthquake, that you made sure that, you know, your very first priority is that they should be sitting somewhere safe where their life isn't in danger and your life isn't in danger. But an extrapolation of that, as Zubeda said, is really that feeling of psychological safety. And, you know, when you're doing face-to-face work with somebody who's in a trauma, we even try and get them into, you know, you might be in a very chaotic situation, but maybe you try and find a quiet corner where you can pull two chairs together and sit quietly, think about who can hear, think about, you know, whether there's a little bit of silence around you. It's not always possible. And of course, COVID is bringing all sorts of challenges for us here, because so much of this sense of connection and safety that we get from a connection with somebody who's speaking to us personally and cares about what we're going through. We used to do that face-to-face, giving somebody a cup of tea, taking their hand, you know, making sure they're sitting comfortably. And when you, as is often the case with COVID-19, you're having to work through digital communication as we are now. All our Zoom communication, or whether it's instant messaging or texting or whatever kind of digital communication you're using, there's still ways to kind of do some of that introductory stuff and make sure that people are feeling safe and comfortable. You can literally say things like, where are you sitting now? Is that an okay place for you to be sitting? Hi, I'm Kerry, you know. You know, tell me about, you know, where you are at now. And you know, kind of do some of that initial joining that makes people safe. And people think when it's digital that you have to get straight into the resolution of something, like transmitting facts. Particularly, say, in email, for example, people forget all about the relational connection. But it's so important, and you can communicate that via digital media.
We spoke also about the element of calming. How can we help calm people in order to reduce their distress?
You want to be able to get the person to focus on the here and now. Sometimes it is about being able to say, what you're feeling is completely okay. It is okay to feel overwhelmed, anxious, uncertain of what's going on, or maybe a little bit confused. What's next? And sometimes even feeling a little bit numb and detached in the situation. Acknowledge those feelings. It's okay that that is happening. So first to be able to acknowledge that that's okay, that it's happening, and then to be able to say, all right, how now can I just connect and come back to being where I am here and now? And sometimes it's about saying to that person in a calm tone, making that eye contact, and simple things like focus on five things around you that's not distressing. Looking at grounding, even if it's placing your feet on the ground, and just being able to feel where you are in the here and now.
I think it's quite important not to provide false reassurance. So, you know, what Zubeda is saying is absolutely right here, you know, that it's about, it's kind of validating what the person is feeling. Like, yes, it is, you know, it is feeling overwhelming right now. Or this is a difficult situation to kind of tolerate. Rather than, you know, it's kind of often when we face with somebody in distress, we want to sort of rescue them. We want to make it better. And we want to come in and say, look, it's going to be all right. It'll be better soon. And say with COVID-19, we don't know exactly how it's going to play out. We don't know where things are. And so to say, yeah, it's really difficult to deal with this level of uncertainty. So you can bring some reassurance in, but it needs to be authentic reassurance, things that we can reassure about. Otherwise, it sort of becomes empty. A lot of people do find deep breathing, diaphragmatic breathing very helpful in calming them down, but you have to be pretty careful when you're meeting somebody for the first time. You don't know what that means to them. It can be quite frightening for people, for example, who are have physical health problems to breathe deeply, especially as you can imagine with some of the symptoms of COVID-19, breathing deeply may not always be the best thing for somebody in a state of distress. So I wouldn't jump in there straight away to kind of offer these sort of magic solutions. It might be better in that case to say to somebody, look, this helps some people. It's certainly not a, you know, an instant solution for everybody.
It might be a good time to talk about some caveats of psychological first aid, the notion that you're not that person's therapist, so you're not providing therapy. Do you want to elaborate on that?
I think that's important to understand that, firstly, you do not have to be a mental health trained professional to deliver psychological first aid. And you are not there to relive the events that have occurred. You're not there to process their emotions. You're not there to debrief them. So what you are there to do is to listen primarily. You're not there to pressure them to talk at all, and it is about being offering information, emotional care and support during a time of distress.
So we've been talking about some of the key sort of features of psychological first aid, and we've spoken about safety being tremendously important as a starting point, and then helping people feel calmer. Probably one of the most important things is to create a sense of connection with a person, where they introduce themselves, say who they are. Culturally, there might be things that you need to do there to make people feel more safe and comfortable for Māori and Pacifica, for example. Karakia might be helpful there. But also kind of then helping them to connect to people around them that can support them. So one of the very first questions I would be asking of somebody in a state of high distress is, who would you normally talk to about this? Are they around for you to talk to them? Is there a way that I could help put you in contact with them? So it's not even the professionals in the first instance that you want to put people in contact with. It's really the people that they love and that they often turn to. And those people can be more helpful sometimes than professional help in those early stages.
I'm just aware that there may be some people who don't speak very much about their emotions or in fact avoid them. So how could we advise on plugging into someone's emotional state?
We all have an innate sense that pushes us towards empathy. And I'm just drawing on my perinatal training here. Rizalasi, I think, describes something called the mirror neuron system that is about our ability to read the emotions on other people. And that gives us an understanding of their internal state. And I think that if we can think about our own feelings in that perspective and tap into our feelings to be able to understand what somebody else is going through, that gives us that capacity for empathy. And that allows us to be able to talk to people and make that connection and to be able to say, I see what you're going through. And I can feel it as well. And that's very important. And once again, it's about that connectedness, making that eye contact and being supportive and being genuine. That's what you're there to do. You're not there to make any false promises. Don't commit to doing things that is not within your reach, but keep to what you can actually do in that situation.
And also just kind of being respectful of the way that people want to deal with something in that moment. So some people are very expressive and they want to talk about their emotions. And then, you know, then it's good to make a space for them to do that and to listen to what they want to say and let them know that you're hearing it.
So from a practical perspective, I think, you know, when you see the person, it is about understanding what are their current needs. And, you know, you need to ascertain what is it that you need in this moment. And it might be a simple thing like, I need to know where I'm going to live tonight. I need to be able to know what my financial situation is. Or I just may want to be able to contact my loved ones and let them know I'm safe, or finding out whether they are safe.
That also links to, you know, one of the other key features of a psychological first aid approach, which is really to sort of give people a sense of efficacy, which is a sense that they can do things, that they can reclaim control. One of the things that these traumatic or crisis situations do to us is they make us feel very powerless and helpless, which is one of the reasons why they're so frightening. And so we help people reclaim their own sense of being able to kind of do things. So in those examples Zubeda was giving about, you know, what somebody might want to do, like I need to let my family know I'm safe, I would say not, okay, I'll go and do that for you. But I might say, well, you know, how would you normally contact them? You know, would you need a phone? You know, here's a phone. Would you like to do that? I would let them do it because that allows them to feel like they're taking charge of something again. And we also know that one of the things that really, really helps people in this kind of situation is helping other people. It gives you a sense of purpose and also that sense of, you know, efficacy that I was talking about. So to have people, you know, in those waiting times while they might be waiting to see whether their loved one is okay or where they are or what's happening, well, is there something you could do? You know, are there people around you that you could be supporting or helping? Could you be making tea for your family while you wait, or for other people in the waiting room? Is that something that would work for you? So just explore ways that people can act. And I mean, we see so much lovely stuff around that at happening at the moment, you know, in communities and neighborhoods around New Zealand, as people are helping each other. And of course, they are helping their neighbors and all the people who need their help, but they're also helping themselves in quite powerful ways. So, you know, that's something to bear in mind too.
It's pretty clear that people do need support and resources to get back to some sort of normal. Can you suggest any supports that might be helpful to access?
The people that you probably want to talk to about how you're feeling in a crisis are the people you love and the people who are around you. So I really want to emphasize that there's so much value in talking to those people who know you, talking with them about what you're feeling, but sometimes just talking with them about anything gives you that sense of sort of connection that can help you through. So professional help is really when you're feeling that's not working for you, or you don't have those kinds of resources available for yourself. In our current situation, the most obvious one is to go with the 1737 helpline number. The risk when somebody's in crisis is that you want to throw all kinds of resources. Try this, there's a wonderful website, here's this, here's it. When people are in crisis, they literally can't take in that kind of information. So one simple piece of information, here's a number you can call. They will tell you what your options are. You know, they can get you to a mental health service. They can talk to you on the phone, and preferably write it down, because in a crisis, again, people don't remember.
The texting of the numbers 1737 is a good idea, but also to understand that you need to direct them towards reputable information. So with us, it is about the Ministry of Health at this stage. So even if it is just to guide them to the Ministry of Health website and to say you're going to get a lot of information there that you might require. But if you need more help, there are other resources that will, like Healthline, that you can call if you are concerned about anything.
And also, people have got a lot of needs with food, housing and finances and so forth. So accurate and timely information about those sorts of things would be helpful as well.
Absolutely.
Just wanted to ask you about this idea of boosting mental health literacy. Because psychological first aid is but one way to do that. and as a public health tool, I suppose, but also in terms of thinking about the increasing awareness of our own emotional well-being and that of others, and how to foster that self-efficacy and hope that you mentioned.
It's very important, firstly, to let people know that what they're going through is normal. It will pass with time. Often it is with good family support, good community support, or support in general that allows you to get through this. And I think the synonym of psychological first aid being community-based psychosocial support is very important. And I think that just taps into the model of well-being that we have, but that community support that is really so important. And I think that community support is what gives us that ability to identify our capabilities and to know that we can move forward and to be able to get through things.
There's been a big emphasis on sort of professionals as a source of support for people. And I'm a clinical psychologist myself. Zubeda, you're a psychiatrist. Part of our job is to provide support to people in distress. But I think it's so important that we don't just professionalize that. That's not very helpful. I think one of the most important things I would want to say to people, I think, is that you actually have the power to kind of support people around you with your kindness, with your empathy, with your understanding. This is not rocket science. This is the stuff of ordinary, humane, interpersonal interaction. And we're asking people to use their own common sense with that rather than simply waiting for a professional to tell them what to do.
The aim of psychological first aid is to reduce that initial distress and then to foster that person's function in an adaptive way, which I think is a really empowering sort of message of hope that anyone can be present with someone.
The people doing the helping in the situation in COVID-19, but also around some of the other traumatic situations we've had to deal with in New Zealand, are also themselves subject to the same circumstances. So if you think our helpers are not outside of this stressful situation that the person being helped is in. And so we really have to also be mindful of the stress that all the helpers, whether they be formal helpers like us as professionals or informal helpers who take up that role in their communities and families, that the kind of stress that they're carrying for themselves, and to make sure that they also caring for themselves and being kind of gentle on themselves, not taking on too much.
With the COVID-19 pandemic, we're going to be facing this in so many ways. We are a shortage of psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health care professionals in general. It's a shortage throughout the world. So we want to be able to say that as a community, we can offer something. There's so many opportunities for us to be able to intervene and just offer some kind of support and care.
Well, thank you to you both, to Kerry Gibson and Zubeda Mahamidi, for helping me explore this question of the role of psychological first aid in times of crisis. And thank you to our audience for listening.
When we come back, greenwashing culture, how journalism, the entertainment industry, and museums impact the environment. And this is poetry from the epicenter of quarantine.
Dear all of us, 4 weeks in and quarantine burrows beneath our skin. We were already so lonely, I don't know if the possibility of our last touch being our last touch might undo us. I place my worries in a box and hope the fragments of me pile up into something bridge-like. Some of us throw our concerns out like life rafts, and some of us aim doubt and disinterest like weapons while we are wringing our hands until something pearls out of this. Something has got to pearl out of this. The night cracks in half as the sirens slice through its quiet. The howls of the coyotes in heat chase their metal song, and all the neighborhood dogs follow suit, and soon the world outside emptied of itself, comes alive with cacophony. It's nice to know the animals are carrying on with their plans outside our windows, wandering the streets, making new lives, singing freely as if the earth was theirs all along. There is something beautiful about us all in times of crisis, the way hope bouquets us together in perpetual spring. There is something brutal about beauty at times like this, refusing to lie dormant while people try not to die.
That was Victoria Lynn McCoy reading a poem from the epicenter of quarantine. Special thanks to Artur Kaizakyan, founder of Letters from Quarantine. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. With us is Toby Miller. He's a professor of media and the author of 29 books, including Greenwashing Culture. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle. Toby, it's great to have you back here with us.
Thanks so much, Maria. Great to be with you.
And what a fantastic book about culture and greenwashing. I had originally planned to start with the way you started the book, with this public relations firm, Edelman. But I think what we should do is talk about culture first and what exactly you mean when you talk about culture. How can we understand it and its effects on society?
How much time do you have? So I guess there are normally two ways in which people conceive of culture, Maria. One would be anthropological or ethnographic, and that is, in a sense, the way in which we live our lives, the way in which when you and I wait for a bus in LA, we know that we have to stand in line, and we know that the person at the front of the line gets on the bus first. All of those things through to, you know, even more mundane elements, but that are quite important, like how you lay a table, where you put the knife and the fork, how these things are agreed, how we learn them, how we organize our daily rituals, that when we go to church or when we're in class, we don't just start speaking whenever we feel like it. We wait until others have spoken and asked for us to speak. That kind of question is addressed by that form of culture. And then there's the more aesthetic or artistic form of culture, which is where those ritualistic norms of daily life are inscribed. So, for example, when we read romance fiction, a Harlequin novel, or a Milton Boone novel, depending on where you are, or a money, sex, power novel with raised writing on the paperback cover, if you still read paperbacks, then we learn about heterosexual mating rituals. And that's done with a particular style that's determined by the genre, by the publisher, by the language, by the kind of readership. Now, as you can see, the distinction I'm drawing between the anthropological and the aesthetic breaks down because, of course, when we read the Harlequin or Milton Boone novel or the Money, Sex, Power novel with the raised writing on the cover, that novel is both addressing the kind of everyday norms of ritual and it is also textualizing them and teaching them. So the anthropological and the aesthetic come together. When that happens, for example, in the form of a museum, the museum or the art gallery is both offering us norms about how to comport ourselves as visitors to a museum and ideas about history or behavior at the same time as it is creating aesthetic understandings about architecture, about beauty, and about truth.
So in a way, it's sort of conveying an ideology as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that ideology, particularly, say, in the space of a museum, is all about, or can be about, how things in the past should be understood, but we've transcended them and now we're somewhere else. I mean, if you think about the current controversy in the US over the tearing down of statues commemorating the Confederacy, I was living in New Orleans for the first half of this year and was present when one of those statues was removed. That is about trying to say we have a past which we have transcended, and then the issue becomes, do you want to celebrate the loss of that past, or do you want to criticize it? So there are very definite ideological components, absolutely.
And so when you wrote this book, one of the theorists that you spent some time on, actually a few of them, were Antonio Gramsci and the Frankfurt School. They argued that the culture industry is a force of anti-enlightenment or mass deception. And then you kind of sprang from there into more present-day theory. Do you agree with them about the anti-enlightenment mass deception of those theorists, or do you think that it's evolved to another stage?
That's a really great question. All your questions are great and quite penetrating. I want to sit on the fence and have a bit each way. Basically, what Adorno and Horkheimer in the Dialectic of the Enlightenment were saying was that regardless of content, the industrialized form of manufacturing culture, which they encountered when they moved to Santa Monica during the war, was creating movies and radio programs in the same way that Detroit was manufacturing cars. In other words, that there was a standardized norm that allowed for a certain amount of difference in order to differentiate different radio shows or Hollywood movies, but that this relied very much on a standard mode of production with minimal disruption to techniques and minimal innovation, and that that was the enemy of what they saw as the great task and gift of the Enlightenment in Kantian terms, namely, and obviously this takes you down the path of German philosophy, the task of making us reconsider ourselves as projects, taking critical distance from ourselves to see who we really are, holding up what might be an unflattering glass to ourselves and saying, I or we as a nation or this family could be better if we did the following things. But that great task of the Enlightenment and of culture was being done in by industrialized modes. Now, as I've indicated with reference to, for example, romance fiction or the money, sex, power novel with the Rays writing on the cover, I don't think that that highly industrialized model necessarily fails to encourage us to engage in critical self-reflection. And lots of ethnographic studies of things like romance fiction have shown that for many heterosexual women readers, the great gift of this kind of cultural production, however industrialized and quasi-uniform it may be, is that when it comes to conversation about their lives, readers of this material, the same thing applies to lots of self-help writing, manage then to take that kind of story, be it fictional or pop psychological, and allow it to become a measuring stick against their own life. Dissatisfaction at the lack of love in their heterosexual relationships, the dissatisfaction at male-female roles, all kinds of things. So yes, I think Adorno and Horkheimer were really onto something when they alerted us to the need to look at what happens when you industrialize culture and manufacture it in the same way as an automobile. But no, I think they were wrong in suggesting that as a consequence, the products, the texts of that kind of culture industry necessarily negate our capacity to engage in critical self-reflection.
Let's turn to your main thesis of the most current book, which is greenwashing. And you spent quite a bit of time documenting and reiterating how much trouble we're in as a planet and how much we're contributing to the destruction of this planet, simultaneous with the greenwashing of the culture industry, so to speak, movies, journalism, museums. Maybe we need to talk about the effects first of the film and TV industry, journalism, in museums. What is the environmental impact?
Well, let's start by saying that most of us would probably assume, as did I until about 15 years ago, that these were comparatively green sectors, by contrast, say, with mineral extraction or aerospace or transportation by car or lots and lots of other manufacturing and extractive industries, and even probably agriculture. And in fact, lots of these sectors advertise themselves as green. And when you see post-industrial societies trying to remake themselves, they often talk about how there will be a green future as they move towards the service or ternary sector, which includes things like the areas you've just mentioned. However, that's not the case. For example, there's a very powerful study of Los Angeles and how within that city, one that is notably polluted by the vast use of automobiles on an everyday basis and trucks and so on, actually in terms of contribution to pollution, the film industry and the television industry, the production end of things, is a greater contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in Los Angeles than transportation. And if you look at the museum sector, you see that one of the things that lots of museums do, whether it's the Tate Modern in London or the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in California, is that they engage in two kinds of greenwashing. The first is that they provide an alibi, one might ironically call it a smokescreen, for major polluters like, say, BP or Shell, in both those cases, who draw upon the goodwill given to them in the public mind by sponsoring blockbuster exhibits or buildings at those famous museums in order to appear as though they are benign entities, part of their search for what they call the social license to operate, so that beyond having commercial and state rights to drill, for example, they also have public acquiescence to do so. At the same time as frequently the museums themselves engage in polluting activity. It can mean, for example, Google searches that are undertaken by administrators and conservators at the museums. Most Google searches are undertaken not necessarily by Google's element itself, but by those who are using it through coal-powered technology. So there's a very dirty coal element to much of our online work that we do. And also because, for example, if you're putting on a major dinner for big donors, then not only are you inviting them using technologies that are very dirty, but, for example, lots of them, and I've witnessed this myself at the Art Institute of Chicago, for example, have their chauffeurs idling the limousines for 4 or 5 hours so they can leave whenever they feel like it, as they prepare to sign or not sign the hefty checks that museums are hoping to receive. So there are all those factors that are at play. There's both the question in the museum sector of providing cover for greenwashing and doing your own greenwashing. When it comes to journalism, there are, on the one hand, certainly the kinds of impacts that come from all the one click away lies all of truth elements of contemporary journalism, where instead of pounding the street in rubber soles to interview people and actually find stuff out in person, many, many journalists are relying entirely on the internet without any sense of how clean and green their own form of energy is, or that of the various routes that the internet takes us on as it speeds around the world to find stuff out and communicate it. And also there are various aspects of journalism that are innately involved in pollution. A famous and very important one is travel journalism. Probably all of us have enjoyed some very good articles by some excellent writers, for example, in the New York Times, about what it's like to go to a certain tourist destination, perhaps even an eco-tourist destination. But of course, what happens is that those writers generally have their airfares paid by the tourism entities that are trying to attract the coverage. They rarely include the carbon imprint of their own journalism, nor do they generally include such issues in the coverage that they provide us with. If you look at all the major journalism federations and unions around the world, even those that themselves are dedicated to reporting on the environmental impact of different industries, rarely engage in any kind of audit of their own carbon footprint. So those are some of the ways in those three sectors you mentioned that I think there's a real problem that needs to be addressed. And it's a problem that isn't obvious to us. We tend to assume, certainly I did, that these are very, very green sectors. To the extent that we know, they're really not.
You actually laid out quite a bit of the environmental destruction within this book, you know, talking about, for example, the health effects of the plastics and wires and monitors that are smashed and dismantled, and this informal economy of rag pickers. How can you help us understand how all of this accumulates and what it really means?
Take a place like Australia, and it, of course, has about 23 million people. It has more than 23 million disposed of cell phones, or mobile phones, as they call them there. One of the problems that a lot of us face in terms of the technologies that you and I and our colleagues at the station are using today is that we're used to the idea that these large or small gadgets work, and then suddenly they don't, and they have to be disposed of. What we're not used to is that they have polluting components, A, at the level of the extraction of minerals to create them, B, at the level of their manufacture, C, at the level of our use, and D, in terms of their post-consumer life. What do I mean by that? Some folks may be aware of the fact that central processing units rely, inter alia, on coltan, which is a composite mineral that basically comes from Democratic Republic of Congo, which, as listeners will be aware, is the site of a horrendous civil war in which millions have died and many more have been raped and injured. A lot of those deaths, a lot of those violations have occurred as part of the conflict minerals industry, which is how the coltan that's in the middle of the cell phone that I'm holding now to my ear to speak to you with is powered in part. So there, and in addition to those human costs, there is a massive impact on the local environment when it comes to pollution of water, air, and earth as a consequence of that extractive work. So there's one example. Another example is at the point of manufacturing. The world's biggest television manufacturer is Mexico, closely followed by China and Vietnam. They basically corner the market. And because Mexico is a democracy, we know a lot more about the experiences of those working in it than we do in the two other nation states. In Mexico, there is extraordinary pollution in the maquiladoras just south of the border with the United States at the point where television sets are created. Then, of course, they come over the border. Let's stick with TVs again for a moment. One of the things about the beautiful new flat-screen digital TVs is that they are energy hogs and they are also quite hot. So in addition to the energy that they use, which is decreasing as the manufacturers become more concerned about such matters, they also encourage many viewers, without thinking about the fact, to be, for example, increasing their use of air conditioning or their use of fans in order to cool the houses and other places in which they're watching the television. Then when a new model comes along, what happens? Well, when we got rid of our old flat screen analogic TVs, where did the hundreds and hundreds of millions, almost 300 million in the US alone, go? Well, they went to West Africa, to Latin America, to Southeast Asia, illegally in most cases, where they were ripped apart, normally by rag pickers, whom you mentioned earlier, i.e. people in the informal sector, in search of the dozens of valuable minerals within them, but without adequate protection against the health risks created to them as informal recyclers by the carcinogenic gases and other properties that are within them. In addition to the horrendous health impact on those people, in addition to all the immediate effects, there are later effects caused from the fact that parts of these recycled television sets, and the same applies to computers and to cell phones and to tablets, are then either buried, in which case they leach into the water table and pollute the soil, or they're burnt, in which case they do the same to the air. So the long-term environmental impacts, as well as the short, medium, and long-term occupational health and safety impacts, are horrendous. Most of us don't think about any of those phases when we engage in the pleasure or the work necessity of utilizing these gadgets. And what we need to do is appreciate that although they may be crucial parts of our lives in terms of family fun or sports enjoyment or going out for the weekend or doing our jobs, they wreak terrible havoc in ways that we can neither see nor hear, but are affecting very materially our lives, our futures, and especially the lives of those in the global south who create the conditions of possibility for our pleasure and our work necessity, and then take responsibility for doing away with them when they've played their part for us.
So let's turn to possible solutions. You argue for a green citizenship, turning more towards a deep ecology where we don't just center on human, we sort of center on the whole picture with the human within it. You see, this is bigger than the nation state. It's got to be supranational. So how would you see this as a possible way of addressing these pretty awful consequences?
One is supposed to end with positive remarks and optimism for the future. You mentioned Gramsci earlier, and he's, of course, famous for many things, not the least of which is quoting Romain Rolland, the French Nobel laureate, who wrote about pessimism of the intelligence, optimism of the will. So this is often wrongly attributed to Gramsci, and the word intelligence is changed to intellect. And one needs both those things. One needs to be looking at the downsides with a serious analytic scrutiny, at the same time as one looks at ways around the problem. And I guess my 25 years living in the United States imbued me a little more with the hopefulness of a Gramsci, as opposed to the horrendous pessimism that my early childhood left me with, by which I simply mean being a teenage Marxist in other countries. So enough of my exciting autobiography. What would this mean? Well, it means recognizing that the stereotype of the environmentalist as the white guy, shaggy-haired, you know, full-bearded, non-hipster, alienated subject who wanders around hugging trees and doesn't connect to issues to do with public policy or commerce or consumption or ordinary people's lives is actually quite wrong. The very significant longitudinal and latitudinal studies of membership of green movements, mostly done in the US, shows that they are cross-class, cross-race, and very cross-geographical. And if you think about some of the ideological objections to environmentalism, you see that it's really a false bifurcation that places environmentalists amongst radicals and anti-environmentalists amongst conservatives. If we turn back the pages to Edmund Burke and his famous negative reflections on the revolution in France in the 18th century, Burke, in objecting to the revolution in France, made one of the most famous remarks that has become a cornerstone of environmental discourse, namely that we have a duty to protect our world, both for our children and for those yet to be born. And that's a long-term conservative tradition. Now, it's warped in the United States by the self-interest of a number of extremely wealthy and powerful corporations and families. But there is a way in which both conservatives and progressives can find common cause in the notion of shepherding our world so that it can be enjoyed and remade by others. So that's one positive note. Another positive note is that there, in addition to being a potentially broad coalition and certainly already a much broader analytic base to environmentalism than we thought, there are some extremely significant moments in the work of non-government organizations, multinational corporations, and states that show the capacity for cooperation across their very different forms of life. To give an example, when it comes to the issues with television sets and telephones and computers that I mentioned, every year Greenpeace puts out a really superb study by its own scientists, often with the cooperation of major corporations, into the green claims and realities of a lot of these gadgets. Similarly, groups involved in militancy in Hong Kong over the working conditions and occupational health and safety of those assembling a lot of our gadgets has been extremely effective in bringing international attention to bear on companies like Foxconn that embark on these kinds of quasi-slave manufacturing protocols. And although the United States is an outlier in the terms of its current administration and that administration's atrocious record on environmentalism, the previous president of France said not long before leaving office, this was François Hollande, we can no longer think of everyday life as a commodity. We have to think of it as something that we look after for the future. So there really are some significant examples abroad of many, many companies, NGOs, and states that are seeking to behave in more responsible ways than we have been used to. There is hope. There is possibility. There is the prospect of a better future.
There were two Latin American examples that you gave, ways of approaching that might be worth considering. One was in Ecuador, the Constitution.
That's right, the Ecuadorian Constitution. And remember, this is a state that for the first time has seen significant power given by the electorate to indigenous peoples in the recent past, recognizes the earth, Mother Earth, and it's gendered in that way, as having rights, as requiring constitutional protections in the same way as free speech or immigration or citizenship rights or rights to cultural expression are granted in many other constitutions. That's a really compelling and powerful notion of how we can hold governments to account in the new kind of constitutional world of environmental citizenship. The other example to which you refer is from Colombia, which is where I work 12 weeks of the year and where I am now. Bogota, which is, of course, the capital, very big city, has for years been maintained informally by the aforementioned ragpickers. These are mostly people who are analphabetic, i.e. they can neither write nor read. Some of them are indigenous and may not speak Spanish, which of course is the official and dominant language of the nation state. And so were always excluded from opportunities to bid for the contracts to be the official cleaners of the city. After some fellow travelers from the left and amongst feminism, because most of these informal workers are women, got together and created a legal challenge to that exclusion that says, well, you can't read or write, so you can't sign a contract. The Supreme Court here ultimately decided in their favor. And so they were able to cut in on the contracts that traditionally had been given to the sons and daughters, particularly the sons of the traditional light-skinned oligarchy that still runs this country. And rank pickers are often the most powerless of the most powerless. I gave examples of people who are picking away at the remains of gadgets. But in addition to that, these people are often stereotyped by otherwise good entities like the World Health Organization and other public health researchers and officials as problems because of the huge amount of really dangerous diseases that they suffer from and therefore the costs they impose on public health. They are rarely seen as solidarity entrepreneurs working together for the common good. And that example is an instance of where, along with some fantastic organization of indigenous rag pickers led by Brazilians, but involving people from South Asia, from Southeast Asia and other parts of the world, have seen how they have common cause and can utilize democratic claims in order to better their situation. So again, as you imply, there is real hope and there has been real progress made by them in terms of being able to dynamize and animate environmental citizenship.
The book again is Greenwashing Culture, and Toby Miller is our guest. He's a distinguished professor of media and culture studies. Well, thank you so much for joining us here again on the Scholar's Circle.
Thank you for giving me this great opportunity.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week. We close with Brian Sonia Wallace reading a poem from the epicenter of quarantine. Special thanks to Artur Kaizakyan, founder of Letters from Quarantine.
They said, stay indoors. And we nomads who'd lived on the salt of the road and the kindness of strangers wondered what our hearts would eat next. We devoured books, filled every corner of ourselves with imagined worlds until we were whole continents. We grew mountainous in our solitude, so tall our eyes crested clouds. We could see each other again, far off, just floating heads and garbled voices in the thin air. May this book be a compass and a grandfather clock, a measure of time and weight in your palm, a presence in a world that's lost its body. I write to touch my thoughts, a friend tells me. The pen, a bridge to the physical world. Eat well, stranger friend. When we meet again, we will each contain new multitudes.